Hey, I'm Derek.
And I'm Noah. And you're listening to A Bite Off,
where we take our current favorite pop culture obsession and enjoy it one nibble at a time.
Spooky month. Spooky thing. Taking a bite. Fall of House of Usher.
Things are falling. Things are ushering. Things are spooking. Things are dying.
We wanted to wait a little bit to closer to Halloween to start talking about this. And how we're going to do this is we're just splitting up this mini series or limited series, whatever they're calling it, into two episodes. So we're cutting it in half. Episode 1 through 4, 5 through 8. Ushering those episodes.
Will one of the ushers get cut in half like we are doing the series?
I think so.
Someone's gotta get sliced real good.
So very excited to be back in the Flaniverse. We are huge fans, obviously. If you listen to us from the beginning, this was the second thing that we covered on this podcast. Bly Manor, we loved it. We covered every episode. A lot of you have been listening to us since then. So hello.
Yeah.
Welcome back. We're back in a haunted little thing.
What's crazy is that there have been three other Flaniverse properties since we did Bly Manor.
Yeah. Well, we covered all of those.
We covered all of them?
Yeah. We did Midnight Mass when we were ranking the Flanagan stuff on Patreon. And then on Patreon, we did the Midnight Club.
Wow.
Yeah.
My mind is blown.
Yeah. So we did those. So, okay, good segue. We have a Patreon. If you want bonus episodes like the ones we just mentioned, $1 a month, free trial, whatever you want to do, support the show, support indie creators. Last thing that I'm going to say before we get into it, housekeeping stuff, we are on our way for 200 reviews, Spotify and Apple. So if you're on one of those, or if you're on both, just like throw some stars our way, just real quick, just scroll down and do it.
If you write something, you can just copy and paste it.
Yeah.
From one to the other.
Well, unfortunately, you can't do reviews, like written reviews on Spotify.
Oh, it's just stars.
Yeah.
All right.
A little easier. All right. So how we're going to do these episodes is we're going to set the stage of our players, right? We're going to talk about all of the stuff leading up to the deaths of these children. And then we're going to talk about the deaths going forward. So we're not necessarily going episode by episode, but we are. It's more death by death.
Very much like how Mike Flanagan kind of takes a bunch of things by one author and smooshes them together into a property. We're kind of trying to dissect that smoosh as best as possible and deliver it to you. So just trust us.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
We'll get into his poetic cinematic universe.
Poetic?
Yeah.
Gorgeous. I love that. But spoiler alert to the works of Edgar Allan Poe.
Okay.
As well as...
Since the 1800s.
Yes. As well as these four episodes, because, I mean, I feel like part of the series is wondering how they're going to die. So if you don't want to be spoiled in that, I would say go check it out and come back.
Yeah, that is true. If you are a fan of Poe and when the episode title comes up or you recognize a name, I'm pretty sure you're going to tell how they're going to die, or at least what the story is going to be about. So if you don't know, be surprised. Also, some of his stories are like not fun to read. So,
I mean, if we thought Turn of the Screw was hard to get through, these are difficult.
That was fun.
That was a wild ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let us officially take a bite of The Fall of the House of the Usher, episodes 1 through 4.
1 through 4. So give me the plot synopsis for the first one, okay, and then we'll like set the stage.
Episode 1, A Midnight Dreary. This is my audible voice. The Usher family appears in caskets and in a flashback in court where it is revealed by Dupin that there is an informant in their ranks. Their patriarch Roderick offers his children $50 million to find out who amongst them is the traitor. Usher calls DuPont to his childhood home, where he tells him the tales of his fallen family.
Ooh, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Fall, House of Usher.
You see?
Get it?
There is some intent in the things that I say on this podcast, I swear.
So we haven't seen past episode 4. So how are you feeling of this new Flanagan show? His last one on Netflix.
So starting with something like The Haunting of Hill House, which is such a great job of balancing family dynamics and trauma with jump scares and spooky ghosts. I don't think anything will ever top that. So I'm enjoying this a lot, but I am missing the creep factor. This feels more like something gross is going to happen in each episode. And there aren't enough like ooky spooky things for me, but I'm still enjoying it. I mean, the writing is phenomenal. The acting is incredible. You can't, you know, go against any of that stuff. I'm just kind of thinking of the overall tone of what we're doing and sort of what I've always been looking for in the Flanniverse properties.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that he has done something different every single time he does something, which is nice. It's refreshing. And it's also smart on his part because then he doesn't necessarily have to live up to Hell House, because that's like, that's on top of the hill. That's like, I mean, I think everybody can agree it's probably going to be most people's number one. Maybe Midnight Mass might be up there as well. I've seen a lot of people saying that Midnight Mass is their favorite, which I love, very much enjoy. But there's something special about Hill House and the family and just the stages of grief. And the bent neck lady was just such a.
Yeah,
but I agree. I'm really liking this so far. I think it's a good mix between Secession and like creepy, gory stuff. So it's just like a spooky version of Secession, which I don't mind.
Yeah,
it's phenomenal.
Definitely.
Yeah.
There's a boardroom. So they're always sitting around a table yelling about something. It's very much like, I want father's money.
Yeah. So this, I feel like this show does take a page out of Bly Manor, where we're getting the present being told of the past. So we have Roderick Usher and Dupont Augie. He's telling him, right, of this is how my kids die. This is how my fault is. I'm going to tell you the story. Very much like how Jamie did in Bly Manor, R.I.P. to Danny. But I really like this. I like this kind of storytelling because there's multiple mysteries happening of like, we're trying to figure out who Verna is, what's happening, but also why is Roderick telling Augie these things in this way? And who's going to die ultimately?
It almost feels like a last chance to tell his story before his fate becomes final, right? It feels like he needs to finally tell the truth of everything. And the interesting thing about this is that when he's telling Augie these stories, it's after the court case is over, right? And the Ushers have won.
No, the court case. No, they died. So like how, no, the court case is still going on.
Is it?
We don't know. I mean, we're four episodes in. They haven't done a verdict of it. Because remember, and I think it was episode 3 or 4, they were like, they were supposed to go to court, but one of the kids died. So then Pym, the Reaper, comes in and he's like, Camille or whoever died, we can't make it. So then they adjourn the court.
Oh, sure.
So the court hasn't technically ended from what we've seen. But yeah.
Oh, so but still, either way, then so it makes it even more mysterious that he's telling him everything that went on before the case has even closed.
Yeah. All 73 of his crimes.
Yeah.
He's admitting to
every single thing from way back in the day.
Yeah.
And everything that's going on with his kids.
And he's going to tell them the true reason, or at least what he thinks the reason is, that the kids have died. They're not like freak accidents. They're all connected in some way. Mm-hmm. So the first story that we get that Roddy tells Augie, I like giving them little nicknames, is of Madeline and Roderick when they were younger with their mother, Eliza. Mm-hmm. And I like, and they're in the house, right? The childhood home, he bought the neighborhood. It's very dilapidated, but still standing in a way. And so we flash back to that. Their mother works for Longfellow, and from what we can assume, it's never really said, is that he's the father of Madeline and Roderick, and this assistant is the mother. And so there's like some weird relationship because she said never go there. His gates are always closed, which Roderick wants to do the opposite later on to all of his bastards and his kids. And this, I feel like, is an interesting way to start it. It's very spooky. It's very Flanagan, right? Their mother is very religious. She doesn't want any help with medicine. She falls very ill. She doesn't want to be embalmed or anything like that. So when they go to Longfellow to ask for help, of course, he pushes them away. He's like, nope, I don't want to do it. Pharmaceutical giants for ya.
Yeah, he's just all about protecting himself and his wife and his fortune, and wants nothing to do with them. And, you know, this, I kept thinking, how close do they live to this man that they keep walking to his home or trying to sneak in? Because he's right there, but yet they can't interact with him
down the street
in any way. Yeah. He wants nothing to do with them. And, you know, there's two sides to that Roderick Coyne, in the sense of, right, they call, Roderick calls, well, he doesn't call, but the kids call a certain set of kids bastards. And then there's like the Usher kids, I guess, from Annabelle. Right. So he was, quote, a bastard. Right. So we see him taking care of them. But yet there's the other side of the coin where he's kind of become just as horrible and corrupt as the person who was his father. Mm. So he's righting one wrong, but he's continuing the other one.
Yeah, we get it. I like the way this story is forming, because we have multiple past stories happening. And it's almost like, you know, this series, we can't really like anybody. I think Lenore is the only one that we can root for or love. Everybody else in this, and that was one of the hurdles that I had to get over watching this, is I don't, like, not that I don't care that any of them die, but I'm just like, they're all kind of awful people. So, like, you get what you give, you know? So I like that he's framing the story, at least how I see it, is how they became awful, or how they became who they are in the circumstances with that. And the first circumstance that we see Madeline and Roderick have to do is bury their mother in the backyard during a dreary night, very dreary night. But she's not dead. And I have some, I'm curious if this is like a supernatural type thing, or if it's whatever medicine or not medicine that she was on, or later on in the series, we get something about nightshade that Victorine uses. So like, was there nightshade involved with her where she was like kind of dead, but not really, and comes back? I'm very curious. I feel like there's always a reason why he does things. I don't know.
I'm personally leaning into the supernatural portion of it, because they bury her. She bursts out of the grave. She kind of scares them for a second, and then she marches down the block and she kills Longfellow, and then she dies. It was like, her spirit couldn't rest until she righted that wrong.
Yeah, I love that they named the character after Poe's mother. It's fantastic.
It's his mom.
Yeah.
Mom and mom.
That's what mom did.
But yeah.
I also like that they gained so much respect for their mother in her final act of killing this powerful man that treated her like shit. Mm-hmm. So it set Madeline and Roderick on a specific path. Roderick and Madeline are very interesting, because Madeline is like the person that is planning, is very cunning, knows what she's doing. Roderick, it seems like, at least in the beginning, is following her lead, or very much listens to her. She encourages wherever she wants him to go, or wherever their path is going. They're twins, I get that, but they're very close.
She's kind of like, it's like the Wizard of Oz. She's the person behind the curtain. Hmm. She's the person that's pulling all the strings and is the one with the actual plan. And so, you know, as adults, you still see that dynamic, but he's obviously a lot stronger. Whereas when they're kids, he's very shy and he kind of follows her lead. And so in the story, The Fall of the House of Usher, we have a brother and sister, right? And part of it, so in trying to figure out like the Poe influence in this first episode, the way The Fall of the House of Usher, the story ends, is that this man buries his sister, but she's not dead. She comes back. And I guess kills him.
Spoiler.
Yeah. But so I don't know if that's going to be the full breadth of this entire series, or is the mother coming back sort of mirroring that story? Because it's almost like the first fall of the House of Usher is their house as children. And then it'll keep going after that.
Yeah. Well, he does say that Madeline is in the basement, so I think it's still alluding to exactly what happens in The Fall of the House of Usher. So I'm curious if she's going to come up, die, fall on top of Roderick, and then he dies too. That's how that story ends. It's very weird.
It's very weird. Yeah.
There is a retelling of The Fall of House Usher, which is one of my favorite books. It's a very short novella, but it's by T. Kingfisher, and it's What Moves the Dead, and it's very creepy. It expands a lot of stuff. There's a sequel coming out next year. So if you like retellings of stories, it's very good. Very creepy.
It is interesting that he keeps, like, we throughout the episodes, we hear that she's in the basement. And all we can really hear is like some tinkering, some metal clanging. So,
like something's behind a wall.
Yeah. So we don't really know what's actually going on down there.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, in the four episodes that we've watched, there's a lot of mysteries going on that we still have answers to. Where is Madeline in the present? And probably dead in the basement, or assumingly dead in the basement.
Or is, I don't, that Madeline, there's something about her. She seems the most evil out of all of them. And, you know, we kind of do hear more about them growing up and how she kind of survived in first foster care and things like that. And one of the things that I'm hoping that we get is I would love to see our current set of Usher kids, as children.
I feel like we're not gonna.
I know we're not, but I feel like it would add a little more to the story to see them as children being awful. And like, well, why did they turn out this way?
The thing is, a lot of the bastards didn't know that they were ushers until in their 20s.
Their 20s, right.
So, I mean, it would be cool to see like where they grew up and how their mothers met Roderick. But man, that's going to be a lot of storytelling, because that's one of the magical things about Hill House, is it kept going back and forth. This one, it's like we have four pasts and a present, and it's like, I would love to see it, but they would have to add like four more episodes.
We would need a whole other series called Before the Fall of House of Usher.
Yeah. So one of the big things that's set up in the first episode is Verna. So we see that during New Year's, I think it's in 1979, just before 1980, and Madeline and Roderick go to this bar that they've never seen before and ask if it's been open before. And Verna's like, it's been here for a certain clientele. So Carla Cuccino.
Kika Belova.
Yeah. Phenomenal. I love that she's always in the Flaniverse, right? We have so many returning characters. We have returning characters from Midnight Club in this one as well. I want to say, if we're going to do like MVPs for like episodes or whatever, she'd win every single one. She's a force in this series, particularly. She's killing it. I love Verna.
Yeah. I mean, Carla Cuccino is really getting what I feel like we've always said Cuccino, yeah. But I don't know. Whatever.
Cuccino.
Yeah. Cuccino. I think I have to say it like that. I think that she is getting to have a lot of fun in this series, because she's not just playing one character. She's a guard. She's a seductress. She's a raven. I mean, she's everything. So I think that she's being allowed to play a lot here, and she's doing it so, so well. So as an audience, I'm always waiting for her to be on screen. I can't wait to see who she's going to be next.
Yeah, we have a lot of theories about her character itself. I have a feeling that we're probably not going to get a definitive answer on who or what she is. And that's fine, because it leaves it open to interpretation and just like following the breadcrumbs of what she does. But I do find it very interesting that they obviously made a deal with her. And it seems like that's Verna's clientele, that something I don't want to necessarily say devil, right? Because it's more like there's a deal that's made and she enacts those consequences of that deal, right? It is a deal with the devil, but like, is she the embodiment of karma? Is she, what is she? But one of the biggest things is, what did they do,
right,
to have to go to that bar to be seen? So to get those alibis, and then what deal did they make with Verna? They're outside of time and space. Mm. Now is the time to make the deal of your life.
Right. And so as we're seeing this sort of young 20s, Roderick and Madeline, we're seeing a picture of their lives where they're struggling. So these rich ushers that we have in the present storytelling didn't exist, right, in the 70s and 80s. And so I'm obviously theorizing that they did something to try and overthrow the pharmaceutical company, or to kill the guy who's leading it or something. But you're right. What was that thing that they did, this big secret that they're holding in, that led them to this bar? And why does the bar appear? Is it so you will get away with this? You will get all the riches that you wanted as long as you make this deal with me.
Yeah, she says something about like, either, you know, two drinks, pay now or pay later. So it's very much like, I'll give you something, but I'm going to ask for payment a little later. So it's assumed that whatever happened during that New Year's is what got them to own Fortunato, because they weren't technically ushers. they somehow were either in the will or somehow got it. I don't know. But there's something that we have to see how they got all this wealth and into this position of power. That's really the basis of episode one. It's setting up a lot of this stuff. I love the scene of showing the kids, or the three caskets that we see of those deaths, but then seeing the kids up on the balcony. It's very, very interesting and spooky vibe. I do miss like the hidden ghosts in the background that weren't apparent. I feel like this one, they're like doing some of those, but it's very apparent mm-hmm. that they're there.
Yeah. No. And I agree. I think that, and it's also, it seems at least within the following three episodes, there is a bit of a formula that's happening. It's like, we know which kid is going to die. We know that they're going to appear behind him as he's telling DuPont the story.
Or fall right in front of him.
Right. Or fall right in front of him. So it's kind of like, all right, you know, oh, how are they going to be covered in blood? You know, whose eye is going to be popped out of their head?
Right.
Just however they're going to appear. But there is that formula there, and it doesn't feel as jump scare spooky as it has in past Flaniverse properties. Yeah.
I feel like that this show isn't predictable. Like, it is, but it's not in a bad way. I think it's supposed to be predictable because we already know they die. Mm. It's just more seeing how that actually is going to happen. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The first episode, we really get to meet all of our players and some of their partners as well. I love all of them. They're all assholes, especially Kate Siegel. She is probably the worst of the worst of them. I would say they're all awful, except for Leo. I feel like Leo is probably not as bad as everybody. Like, he has his problems and he has a drug problem, but
he's a cheater. He's got drug problems. But as far as like hurting other people, except for his boyfriend, he's fine.
Yeah. But I love their chemistry and their interaction. And it is sad that that's the only time that we actually get to see all of them interact, when they get new NDAs and a bounty on each one of their heads. So, speaking of the bounty, do you think that there is actually an informant within the ranks? Because we have so many characters. We have the new wife. We have the grandkid. We have him, the Reaper himself. Do you think that there actually is or there isn't?
I feel like there is, but I don't think it's one of the core kids. Hmm. I feel like it's someone on the outskirts. Like, part of me is like, it's Lenore. It's the grandchild. She's just selling them, you know, send them all up the river, because there is that really fun discussion between her and her father, where he's like, there's a mole. And she's like, no, it's not a mole. It's an informant. There's
See, she knows the difference.
That's what I'm saying. She's very knowledgeable about moles and informants. So I feel like there is someone, because when it comes to this, right, we learn that for DuPont, that this has been his life's mission to take down the Ushers. And so to lie that fiercely about something that huge, you know, feels a little too desperate.
Yeah.
To me,
I don't think there is. Mm. I feel like that we see when the graves are exhumed, right? He's posing as a cop to go like get pictures and to investigate that. It doesn't seem like he's not unwilling to bend the law a little bit or to go a certain way to get justice. You know, he's going to people's doors without warrants or anything like that and saying like, do you work for this person? I need to ask you questions. Mm. Like, they're bad. So I feel like to finally take down the House of Usher, he's like, I'm going to make them fight it out within their ranks, and hopefully one of them will like come forward and then be the informant. That's my personal theory. If you've seen the whole series, don't tell me what it is yet.
They're going to tear each other from the inside out.
Yeah. So that's really episode one, right? It's setting the stage for everything. Let's get into episode two, because this is our first death that we see, and it's probably Mike Flanagan's most violent and grossest thing that he has done in his series.
This feels goriest for sure. So episode two is The Mask of the Red Death. The youngest of the bastards, Perry, has yet to prove himself to his father and decides to take his project into his own hands. Precipitation becomes Perry's prime problem.
Ew. Yikes. Acid, no bueno.
Acid rain, baby.
So I do really like that each episode, it seems like we're going to focus on one of the kids and ultimately their death. Perry is like 25, doesn't really know what he wants. We do hear that each one of the kids gets like their nest egg is a business. Like, Madeline and Roderick will fund whatever business they have. But I like that they have to pitch it to them, mm-hmm. right? So like we have Camille, she's like the spintress PR person.
Yeah, she's a PR maven.
Leo will fund video games. He doesn't build them, but he funds them. Mm-hmm. You know, Victorine is not a doctor, but she's like in the medical field.
She's like a scientist, maybe? Yeah.
Froderick is just a Roderick. is just Roderick, but like not yet mm-hmm. Roderick. What is it? Tamerlan is Goop. She's Gwyneth Paltrow. Mm-hmm. That's it. Am I missing somebody? No, that's it.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so many characters. So apologies if we like miss somebody. Mm-hmm. But so his idea, I think it's really cool. I don't think it's like a sustainable business, but it's really cool. He wants to throw parties for the wealthy and the elite and then blackmail them. Mm. He has cameras everywhere. It's a fantastic idea, but how many times are you going to get people to go to those parties when people are getting blackmailed?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most sustainable business, I would say. And I feel like he really represents the youngest generation. His kind of need to be all about sex, drugs, party, and there's technology involved. It's like he's a YouTube vlogger gone bad. It's mm-hmm. like he's an influencer that's lost his way. And so Madeline and Roderick are like, no.
Well, Madeline seems very opposed to it. Mm. She's just like, get this fucking kid out of my face. Mm. And there is this sad thing of like, you know, Frederick and Tamerlan are the original kids from Annabelle and Roderick. And then the rest of them are bastards. That's the word that they chose to use. So we're going to use that word. And it seems like even Madeline treats them that way. Like, why are there more kids here? Like, stop making us spend more money on these kids and have to deal with them. And within those ranks, it's like some of the bastards group together, but it really seems like Tamerlan just does not give a shit about any of them.
Yeah, she gives me very much mommy vlogger, white supremacist vibes.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, exactly.
She's not as white supremacist. No, sorry.
Gwyneth Paltrow isn't. But it just seems like she looks down on those who come from different backgrounds as her, that she doesn't see as pure of Usher blood. And she really has no interest in getting to know them.
No.
And you can even see that through the storytelling. It's like she shows up at the dinners when she has to. But other than that, she doesn't want anything to do with her family.
Yeah.
Ugh. Tammy. She's got problems of her own.
Perry's story and the culmination of his story is very interesting. He seeks help from Leo, which is, I think him and Leo have a good relationship, and he goes to him and Leo gives him some good advice. Like, look, what you're doing now is probably not what you're supposed to do, but once you figure it out, you'll be good. And I like that of Leo. I feel like some of the kids keep going to Leo until his ultimate demise in episode 4. But they go to him and he does speak some reason to them. I like that. I like that about Leo. But Perry needed some guidance. I think he could only throw that kind of party once. It's not going to work after that.
It was really, I mean, it was a bizarre choice. And the thing I like about Leo is Leo feels like the one who's most down to earth out of all of them. And the fact that they go to him to just kind of either, I mean, they're getting drugs and getting high, but I feel like they really see him as an outlet. Hmm. And so it was kind of sad, you know, that his ultimate demise is only halfway through the series, which is kind of a bummer. But I think for Perry is just so delusional about who he is and what he deserves. And
he doesn't know yet.
He doesn't know.
He even had to shadow Froderick, and he couldn't even do that. Yeah. As soon as he saw that there were condemned buildings that he could use for his party, then it piqued his interest. But this idiot should have actually paid attention, because then he would have known that the tanks on top of this party probably didn't actually have water in them. There's a reason they were condemned and also abandoned for a reason. We later learn that Roderick stored chemicals that weren't legal and they couldn't actually dispose of. So that was actually fun to find out that it wasn't like Verna that filled those tanks with acid or anything. They were just already there. She just flipped the switch.
Right. Exactly. She's just kind of like, well, this is what you've chosen to do. And mm-hmm. this is what you're going to have to face.
The scene with Verna coming into that club in the red cloak, in that skull mask, just visually was so cool. It was sex. It was mystery. It was terrifying. It was revenge. It was death. I loved it so much. I didn't realize how gory this was going to get until it actually happened. So good.
They really played with the sound effects for this of like, exactly like the melting of their bodies together and the
groans,
and the smushing of their muscles. It was really, really righteous. One of the interesting things about this death in particular, other than it just being horrendous, was that it actually involved another family member. Mm-hmm. So Frederick?
What? Yeah. No, that's what they call him.
His name's Frederick.
Frederick.
Okay. Yeah. Like, Frederick, his wife is lured there by Perry. And so she doesn't die, but she does. Basically, she's doused with acid.
She's melted.
Yeah. And so she's in intensive care for the last couple of episodes. So I'm still curious as to why this has now become a part of the Usher puzzle.
Well, I think that it doesn't even matter with, so Frederick and Lenore and Morel, I think that's her name. They seem fine. I think out of everybody, they have what seems to be the healthiest relationship, but then it does show that crack, right? It shows that she was easily lured to that and lured with the expectation of sleeping with her 25-year-old brother-in-law. Gross. So I'm very curious to see what her ultimate story is going to be. Unfortunate for Lenore, she's losing her aunts and uncles, and her mom is not cake. She's a mummy.
I know. Apparently making lifelike cakes can only take you so far in happiness. You need some other venues.
That scene was so funny. And I love how Roderick was just all for it. She was like, oh, here's a coffee. And he's like, no, it's not. I'm like, really? This is what tickles you?
Well, I think for Roderick that this is another one of his investments. So he's just willing to put up whatever front he has to make someone think that they're doing a good job as long as it makes him money in the end.
I feel like all of the spouses or the partners in this series have like ridiculous jobs, except for Victorine's partner, because she's an actual doctor.
Yeah.
And seems to be that she has a good head on her shoulders.
We don't really learn much about Leo's partner. The boyfriend.
No, yeah. He seems nice and supportive.
He just has a cat. That's it.
He still has one.
Good for him and the cat.
So the scene leading up to everybody getting melted in this club, I loved it. So we see Verna goes to them, and I feel like this one was the nicest of them. Like she almost, you know, she told Perry, like, we could have had a lot of fun, but tonight's a consequence and you're consequential. And it seems like she's almost like bummed that she has to do this. I mean, she wasn't when she ultimately flipped the switch, but like it did seem like she wished that things could be a little different because maybe he aligns with what she likes to do. Right. Mm. And he could lure people that she needs. I don't know, but I really liked that writing that happened in that scene in that bedroom between these two.
One of the things that I wonder is, if for Verna, she knows that even though these kids are awful, they are paying someone else's consequence. Mm. And so, you know, even though whatever she is, death, the devil, she can still see going like, sorry, this is going to happen to you, but it's your fate. You know, this is your problem now. And so in these sort of monologues that she has before them, it always seems like there's this thought of choice and kind of having to deal with consequences of maybe something that you didn't even choose.
Yeah. Or there's a couple times, and I believe, especially with Camille so far, she says, you don't have to be here. Like you, why are you here? I'm not going to open that door for you. Mm-hmm. And even with Perry, tonight's a consequence and sorry.
Yeah.
Like, you're here. You did this.
In looking at the source material of this post story. Mm-hmm. So this actually, the post story takes place in a kingdom and it's Prince Prospero, and his kingdom is dying of red death. And so what does he do? He has a party with his friends.
Yeah, asshole.
Right.
It's so, like the people that threw parties during COVID.
Exactly. So instead of taking care of his kingdom, he just cares about himself. And then one day, Red Death shows up at their door and takes them all down, and they die in a pile on the floor. Ugh. So it's very much mimicking, you know, what happens in the story. But it almost feels like in the story, there's a choice of doing bad. Mm. Right. And so in this, Perry is doing bad. He's going against his father. He's going to blackmail people. But it does seem like you're just a stupid kid.
Well, it also seems like Morel kind of got the choice, right? She had the choice of not to go when Perry initially gave him that burner phone. And also Verna went to her and was like, get out.
Yeah.
And she still didn't. I'm glad that she went to the wait staff and the workers and she was like, guys, you need to leave.
Yeah.
Great. Save them. Everybody else, you seem very awful. So
yeah.
I'm sorry. Don't wish death, but like, oh. Yeah, she definitely had a choice and she decided not to. I'm curious if we're ever going to hear her speak again or like what the reasons were.
Something's going to happen. I mean, there's a reason that she's still alive right now.
Yeah.
So there's going to be something that comes from her.
All right. Let's talk about the third one.
All right. Episode 3, Murder in the Rue Morgue. Obsessed with being the captain of her family's public image, Camille goes on the public relations warpath. Becoming too wrapped up in her own wrath, she tries to uncover her sister's secrets, but finds a lab of pissed primates instead. That's one thing I don't appreciate about this show is the poor monkeys that keep being murdered.
Okay, well, all the animals that get murdered end up doing the murdering. So like, I'm here for it though. They get the revenge.
That's true. I did appreciate that. But in the first episode, we're watching them get cut open and I did not like it.
Yeah. Thankfully they're all CGI. So like that helps with like
very not true.
Real animals being there, except for the cats, but like, it's fine. So these two episodes, I'm very sad because I love Raoul Cooley and I love Kate Siegel. And we lost them so early in this. I'm like, no, Kate Siegel.
I know. And she really performed her ass off in this episode.
Let's talk about her thing, right? We talked about Perry. Let's talk about her a little bit. And, you know, she has an awful job, right? She spins. That's what she does. She has a PR firm and she's here to spin everything. Even with the conversation of like, Perry's stuff has to come from the outside. It can't come from the family. And she's like, no, it's going to come from me. We need to do all this stuff. And it's like, she can't even deal with the fact that one of her siblings died. It's all just a job for her. And she's like, I have to do this. And not to mention the weird relationship she has with her assistants. It's like, ick, but like, good for you, but ick.
Well, they're like her concubines.
Yeah.
They're like,
They work for her.
Yeah. Like they have to, she sends them out to get information, to spy on people, to, you know, talk to their contacts and bring it all back to her. And then at the end of the night, she's like, take your clothes off.
Mama's tired.
Yeah. It's very bizarre. It's very, very weird. And she's like, you signed a contract.
Yeah. I do want to say she looks fantastic in a silver wig.
Oh, this hair. I kind of can't. With the hair. I mean,
no, you know whose hair I can't deal with?
Tell me.
Is Madeline's hair. Like current day Madeline.
Oh my gosh, I know she's got to bump it.
That wig is not great.
That is weird. I agree.
It's not great.
I agree. This wig, the Camille wig, is fantastic. I'm just like, why does she have silver hair?
Because she's an heiress. Because she is like, I'm cool.
She's an ice queen.
Yeah. She has no feelings for anybody else. She'll take everything and spin it.
She loves it too. Yeah. That's what's kind of sickening about it. She can't wait to take what really happened, the evil, the tragic, and spin it to make it look good. Mm-hmm. Like they were always angels all along.
Yeah, she's awful, but I love her. I love her outfits. I love her snake lingerie that she'll wear under a blazer. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, she's always got like a harness on no matter what. Work, home, pleasure, pain, doesn't matter. Wearing a harness.
I love that at the end of the day or before her death, when the last time she's with her assistants when they pretty much quit. I like how she's like, I just want to starfish for a few hours. And she literally just flops on the bed.
I also love that we learn, I think their names are Toby and Tina. Mm-hmm. We learn that Tina's name is really Beth. And she's like, well, I call you Tina because Toby and Tina makes me giggle. Yeah. Or whatever she said. It was like, she just decided to change her name.
She's insane.
Yeah.
So aside from Camille's story in this one, we do get some past stuff. And you know, we find out a little bit more about Roderick and his rise to getting at least into the pharmaceutical space. And he like pitches stuff to Griswold. who is in real life Poe's actual nemesis. So I thought that was interesting that they have him in here. And it shows that he is rising, or he's at least trying to do something, right? He's trying to change the world. Their resolution was to change the world, right? And this is before all that. In the conversations that he has with Annabelle and when Madeline is there, it very much seems like Annabelle is like, well, let's do the right thing. Like, you pitched it. Let's see where it goes. Madeline is like, no, you need to manipulate your way up into the ranks. I don't like this relationship. I do feel like if there was a deal made, right? All this stuff is coming to Roderick's kids. I have a feeling that Madeline made him make the deal and he's going to reap all those consequences. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she definitely manipulated him. It does feel like Madeline is the devil on his shoulder and Annabelle is the angel on his shoulder. And we know from the future that Annabelle isn't there anymore. Right. So Madeline definitely ends up winning.
She kills her. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thought I had, but it does really feel like she's probably going to get sick.
Right. Annabelle Lee, if you know that story.
Yeah, it's a very sad poem.
Wind comes from the cloud and she dies.
And the angels and all the angels were jealous, so they wanted to take her. It was very terrible. So, and that's the thing, is that Annabelle, out of this full cast of characters, is really the only likable one.
And what's her name? Oh my God.
Lenore.
I was going to say Lorraine. It's not her name.
But you know, I have my suspicions about Lenore.
Yeah. Yeah, she, in the conversations with Augie and Roderick, he keeps saying that he's getting texts from Lenore. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe. Mm-hmm. But the story of the Raven is this guy that's grieving his wife, Lenore, and the Raven is there mocking him for his grief. I hope that nothing happens to Lenore. Is she really texting him? What is happening?
Maybe it's just Verna like being like, 2 hours left, yeah, maybe. An hour and a half left. I'm coming.
The death of Camille was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was terrifying. I mean, I can't. Verna, you know, freaking Carla, like, dear God, she acted like a security guard, a badass security guard. And then she acted like a security guard, but a monkey.
Think of the layers. She is the Raven as a security guard, as a monkey. That's a lot.
It's a lot.
That's a lot.
I think that, you know, whenever she's speaking to the siblings that are about to die, you know, she's really speaking to them. Perfect execution of all those monologues of just laying it out in front of them, telling them, like, this is why this is happening. Like, I'm going to tell you that these are the circumstances of why you're here and what's happening. I loved that. Camille at the end was just like, okay, fine, do it. got mine.
Yeah, I'm just going to take this picture of you, whatever. This is my fate. And that's the thing. Maybe the thing with Camille is that she knows when she can spin something and she knows when she can't. And in that moment, there was no way of getting out of it.
Defeated. That whole situation was terrifying. I felt like this was probably the scariest part for me because Camille was in there, even though I don't necessarily sympathize with her. I sympathize with her as a person, or putting myself in that room with those monkeys that were making those noises, getting scared, and then having this person in front of you acting scary as fuck. Mm. It was a very tense situation, but she got smashed.
Yeah, it did feel like justice. And in reading the Poe story, I was like, you know, how is he going to relate, you know, these monkeys killing Camille? Like, wow, like, that's so random. And then in the story, an orangutan kills the Camille character. And I was like, well, Poe actually wrote that. Okay. Yeah. All right. I see. Didn't actually go too far off the page with that one.
No, something that happens, and the way that these people die in the show or how they died in the Poe stories. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing and fun thing to see is how Mike Flanagan weaved all of that stuff together.
Right.
So it's like, of course, Victorine is experimenting on this heart thing, and why Roderick is so invested in her work is because he needs it to save himself because he has a condition that will help it. But then that brings in the monkeys so that way Camille can die later.
Right. Exactly. That's why the monkeys are truly there.
It's so good.
Just to kill Camille. I've been reading the stories after I watched the episode because I don't want the story to spoil the episode for me. So I like watching the episode, seeing how they die, and then seeing what Flanagan actually pulled from the Poe story. I recommend that order. Mm. That way you're not like, okay, well, I know that the monkey's going to get her at some point. Because in starting to watch the series, I would have never thought that the monkey was going to kill Camille.
Yeah.
You know,
I do like the scenes that we get throughout these episodes with Roderick and Augie. We get a few of them, right? Because it's narrating the story and telling it. And I like that he is getting haunted by hallucinations of his kid's death and Augie doesn't see it. Mm-hmm. And Augie is just like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah.
Like, no, I don't want your $1 million cognac. Why are you freaking out? I love the part where I think it's when in the next episode when Leo falls in front of him and he freaks out and Augie's like, don't you yell at me.
Right. Right. He's just like, don't. You know, that is not a tone I appreciate, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do like that. And I like Augie as these episodes have been going on. He's actually becoming, I don't know if frightened is necessarily it, but he's feeling more uncomfortable in this conversation because Roderick is getting more and more intense. Mm. You know, also, Roderick delivers this entire monologue about lemons.
Oh, yeah.
At some point. And basically how we're all just pawns in capitalism.
Oh, yeah.
And it was incredible.
That's to Mike Flanagan's strength, right? He writes these monologues. And I will say, I think Midnight Mass has the best written monologues I've ever heard in my life. But that lemonade one was just insane because he was like, well, life gives you lemons. Augie's like, make lemonade. And he's like, no, what you're going to do is all of this stuff. And it's like, what? The way that somebody can think about that is terrifying. And it goes to show that, oh, no, they actually do this.
Yes, absolutely. Like, absolutely.
What happens, especially with fruit.
That's why Taylor Swift, something about cardigans. I don't know. It was all just a ruse for the wool industry or whatever.
So I'm very excited to see how that. Part, like the reason why he's saying all this, right? Like, what is the connection between telling the story of his mother in the beginning to now? Is it to show that he was a bastard himself or he didn't grow up where he was supposed to and this is where he became? So I'm very interested to see how that connects to the ultimate meeting of Verna to then why all the kids are getting killed.
Yeah.
So he's very much laying the groundwork for all of this to be connected at some point, that typical ending of the series for Flanagan where everything's going to be like, oh, it was not what I thought it was.
There's an interesting moment in the first episode after their mother breaks out of the ground. She grabs Madeline and she stares at her.
I think it's Roderick.
Oh, well, she grabs one of them and it almost feels like a transfer, like something in that moment happened and changed them. And it was like, that's what set this all off.
It's me. It's you. It's us.
Oh, yes. Totally. Yes. It just felt so like she was going to attack them. But then it was like, it's my child. And then she goes on. Mm. So I thought that was such a cool moment. I just keep coming back to that. I keep thinking about it.
Maybe because he's related to Roderick and all she could do, or not Roderick, Longfellow. And all she could do was kill Longfellow. And part of him was in him. And who knows? I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Mm-hmm. All right. So in episode 4, it's the Black Cat. Reeling from the death of his sister, Camille, Leo goes on a bender and murders his boyfriend's black cat. In an act of desperation, he adopts a doppelganger only to find that this kitten is playing mind games.
Oh, this is, I'm going to say it now, my favorite episode so far of the 4.
Mm.
I really liked the pacing. I really liked the acting. I thought Verna gave a performance of terrifying kitten beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the paranoia and the intensity that Raoul Cooley plays and that Leo exhibits. It's just really good. It's one of those things of like not a reliable narrator almost, because was that hallucinations? Probably. Was it not? Maybe. I don't know. But it's a really cool way to frame this story. Black Cat is actually one of my favorite Poe stories. It's very short and it's fun. It's a fun way to like make the cat kind of come out on top in the end, but it has that thing of like, okay, why did he kill that cat? Like, why would he do that? I mean, he didn't really, but like, why did he think he killed that cat? It's an interesting way to like piece together why would this character do that when he doesn't seem like he would.
There's a piece of me that feels like the cat represented him having to take the next step in this relationship. Mm. And he couldn't handle that. As we see in the first episode, he's cheating on his boyfriend and he cannot deal with the fact that he has to make a decision.
Poor Julius.
Yeah. He thinks his cat's dead and then it's gone missing and then it's back, but it's really a devil cat. It's too much.
And then his boyfriend is beating up the walls with Mjolnir.
Well, I mean, yeah, Thor was there. And I think in the grand scheme of things, Julius really should run far, far away from the entire family. Mm. He actually got an out and maybe he'll be safe now.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, he never brought him around the ushers, and I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. He was never invited to those dinners. He didn't have to sign an NDA or anything like that. So good on Julius. Run away. Get whatever. Hopefully he left you something and just leave. Don't go to the ushers.
And, you know, Camille really liked Julius. And I don't think the Camille seal of approval is actually a good thing. So I'm glad that he got away.
But she's so cool that, like, I wouldn't mind it.
See, I would hang out with Camille, who's high. Like, high Camille was kind of chill.
Yeah, she was.
Camille every other point in time, no. But you do kind of bring up an interesting point that Julius has never had to sign an NDA. Mm-hmm. So
Victorine's partner did. Everybody else's did.
And Julius is queer and DuPont is queer. So maybe they met at some sort of business person's LGBT night or something like that. And he was like, by the way, I'm dating one of the ushers. Here's all the information I know.
I hope it's not that. That'd be too easy. That's too much of a giveaway. I like that these episodes are furthering the story of some of the other siblings, as well as telling the focus story on one of them. So we got the Victorine part, Vic, and having Verna pose as this person that needs help with the heart. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was, it's not working on the monkeys. But she's going to go ahead and do human trials anyway, because she doesn't want to tell her father that her thing isn't working, because he also needs it. But he hasn't told anybody that he needs it. So it's a very high tense situation. And I understand why Vic is doing this, but, like, don't mess with people's lives, let alone innocent monkeys' lives. It's not good.
Yeah, an actual human person, right, who you're actually stealing from your girlfriend's clinic. Like, it's pretty shitty.
Yeah, it's really shitty. Her partner, Alessandra, has the head on her shoulders. Whenever the monkey died and she gave it adrenaline, and she was like, it wouldn't have worked anyway because you polluted the trial. So it seems like whatever's going to happen with them, I'm scared. I'm scared for Alessandra, because she does seem like she's good. But could she be the informant? Because the scene where Pym was handing out the NDAs, she's like, I'm going to have my person look at this. Like, she almost didn't want to sign something to then put herself in, like, constraints of not being able to say anything.
Yeah. Ugh. We do have these people on the outside of the inner circle who definitely could be the informant.
I don't think it's built.
Oh,
Tamerlan's husband. He seems like a good guy, but he seems like a doofus.
He's such a product.
Yeah.
He's just like her little plaything that she tells to do his workouts on lives and stuff like that. Oh, poor Bilt. He eats dinners with the paid person so she could masturbate to it.
Hey, she likes to watch. Oh, she's a foodie, as you called her.
She's a foodie. She loves watching people enjoy food. She just really gets off on it.
Yeah. So back to Leo's story. Real fucked up that his situation is like, I'm going to go just get another cat and, like, pretend it's Pluto. It's
not. And in that moment when he's going to adopt the cat, when Verna is there as the person who's running the shelter, again, she's like, this cat, people are after this cat. I don't know if it's going to be available. Maybe don't do this. And he still does it. She always gives them the choice to not do the thing.
And of course, they're going to do the thing.
They always do the thing.
They always do the thing. But her whole thing, whenever she appears to him in his manic state of destroying the wall, is so good. And it's terrifying. So she played a monkey in the last one, and she plays a terrifying cat in this one. I loved, so in the story of the black cat, this man has a wife, loves the cat. He ends up, like, just not being able to understand this anger that he's having towards, like, this cat that loves him so much, and he just can't help it. Like, he ends up, like, plucking the cat's eye out, blah, 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 all this
stuff. That was disgusting.
Yeah, they did do this in this one. But I love, so the shot with Verna and the cat in the wall is literally how that story ends. He ends up killing his wife, and he's putting his wife in the wall in the basement. And when the police come to investigate, like, where's his wife, where's everything, he accidentally put the cat in the wall as well. and the cat was meowing and making noises. So the police were able to find the body and actually rat him out. So I liked that. Mm-hmm. And I liked that in this episode, nothing happened to Bluto in the first place. He probably just got out.
Yeah. This is animal justice. This whole series is just animal justice.
Because we get the scene of like all of the presents and stuff that these cats left for him in the bathtub. It was never there.
Yeah, no one else could see it.
So none of this actually happened. So Julius never saw the cat when Leo was like, grab the cat. It was right there. And he's like, what? Mm. So he never saw any of this stuff happening. So Raoul Cooley was just going apeshit in this.
Yeah, I mean, is there something to be said about the fact that he does the sort of street recreational form of one of his father's drugs? Mm. And that maybe it was eating away at his brain and that's why he lost his mind.
You know what? Okay. So I almost forgot to even mention this, right? So Ligodome is the drug that young Roderick pitches to Rufus. And blah, 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 years later, that is the drug that Leo does push. It's like a version of it that they push out. His wife, we didn't even talk about Juno.
Oh, yes, Juno.
So she is very interesting, and I'm curious to see what the deal is there. Everybody hates her, especially Tamarin. She's like, it's talking again.
Freaking Tammy.
It's so sad. She also like says inappropriate things to Lenore.
Yes. The thing about Juno is Juno looks like they picked some random, I don't know, street urchin and then threw some Chanel on her in a black wig. Like, she looks so uncomfortable in all of these like beautiful designer clothes.
That's literally who she is.
Yeah. And she can't help but still be herself, and none of them can take it. None of them like her.
So it's his current wife. And I have a feeling that she is this rare case of somebody that has so much of this drug, didn't die, is still able to function and everything. And he wants to like have this case study. Mm. So Roderick married her to keep her close. Mm-hmm. That's my feeling on it, because she was a drug addict. She had so much Ligodome. She survived all this stuff. So, and then he fell in love with her. It really does not make sense.
Yeah.
So there's something going on there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what that drug is actually doing to her. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, Juno is really this character who kind of just floats in and out of scenes, says something silly, and then disappears. Yeah. So I am curious to see of why she is there. Mm-hmm. And if it is just some sort of greater plan by Roderick, who obviously isn't afraid to use people in order for him to get gain in his life.
And also, I just want to say Ruth Codd, fantastic. She was amazing as Anya in the Midnight mm-hmm. Club. So yay.
You know, it's if you get a Flanniverse role, you must be like, yes,
God,
because he's going to bring you back, you know, if he really likes you. But like, I mean, most of the Midnight Club kids are in this. Even Lenore is the young girl from Dr. Sleep. I mean, he brings people back. And I love that. I love when people come back from prior properties.
It's almost like, and nothing on If You Like American Horror Story, right? It was good. Not anymore, personally. But I feel like Mike Flanagan found a way to do these anthology stuff, but you can separate who the actor is with the character mm-hmm. very easily. Because mm-hmm. I feel like he really puts them in different situations. Whereas I feel like American Horror Story was like, that's Sarah Paulson. Yes. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah, right? Because they kind of act the same the whole time, or they're the same notes. This one, I feel like he lets his characters be such different types of people. And I think he casted all of them perfectly.
I mean, I really think that goes to his writing. Mm. He's able to write characters with depth, whereas something like American Horror Story, you know, it's almost the opposite of what I was saying earlier, where like American Horror Story is just trying so hard to be creepy and shocking, whereas this is getting into the depth of why humanity is the way it is. And if a ghost pops up every once in a while, well,
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he can make a ghost love story and it still be terrifying, but also very sad. He writes the sad horror stories that we love.
He is Poe. You know,
he is Poe. So I, the scene where Raoul Cooley, Leo, actually does kill himself by trying to get the cat on the balcony. I thought he was going to hit that car. He didn't. He just fell right on the sidewalk.
We don't want to ruin a nice car. I did not like...
They're like, not in the budget.
No, I did not like when the cat scratched his eyeball.
Ooh, That was probably the scene out of all these episodes so far where I was like,
yeah, I barely saw it because I closed my eyes so quickly. And I was like, no, I don't want to see it. But yeah, seeing him lose his mind and just breaking up every wall in that apartment, it was like, this isn't a home reno show, people. Mm. This is just someone completely losing it. And I thought, you know, definitely sad to lose Leo so early, but I can't wait to see how the rest of them go.
He was the only one that actually cared that Perry died. Mm-hmm. He was very sad about it. He didn't want to go talk to the press. He was like, no, you do it. You want me to say this? This, like, as if I don't know who this person is. It's very sad. Like, he was, I feel like, one of the good ones out of all of them. And it's very sad to also lose Kate Siegel. They'll still be there. They'll be in the background, but I don't think they're going to get any speaking roles.
No, I think that's it as far as the story goes on, unless we have another flashback of some sort. But it feels like we're continuing on the Roderick interview with a vampire storyline and seeing how the rest of them die.
So let's wrap this up with a few things. So the questions that we still have is, what was the deal that they made with Verna? Mm-hmm. How did Madeline and Roderick get the company and where they're at, and ultimately what their end game is? Who's actually in the basement? Mm-hmm. Right? How the other siblings die, but what is up with Juno and the relationship with Roderick? Right? Is that all the mysteries so far that we have?
And who the informant is.
And who the informant is, if there actually is one. I will say, okay, favorite episode overall, the Black Cat. Favorite death overall, Camille. So far. Mm. I just like those two. I thought her death was the creepiest, so well written, amazing. But overall in an episode, Black Cat was probably my favorite. Also, Raoul Cooley. It was yellow. I loved it.
Absolutely. Yes. I see that. I think my favorite episode is the first one. So far,
it was so strong.
I love getting to meet everyone, seeing all their quirks, kind of figuring out what's going on with all of them. The introduction of our first ghost popping up, and my favorite death. Oof.
Why do you actually brought? Okay, so I forgot that in the first episode, I believe it's the first episode, after he tells the story of his mother, Augie is like, "Why are you telling him this? Why are you talking about your mother?" And Roderick's like, "Oh, I assumed I'm supposed to because she's here." And we see her behind him. Why is she still? I mean, I know he has that that disease, that disorder with him, and it causes hallucinations and stuff. But it is interesting that she is there. I just thought I would bring that up. Like, why is she still haunting him particularly?
Well, this one, I wonder if it isn't so much that she's haunting him, but she's haunting the house. She always will be in that house.
She's just thinking about it. Yeah, she's there.
Yeah. And I think that's also another question, right? Of, are these hallucinations or is it really their ghosts?
Right.
So, yeah. And my favorite,
none of them are reliable.
No, not at all. And I'm here for it. I like having that big question mark. My favorite death. Oh, gosh. I don't know if I have a favorite death. I mean, I think the most gruesome one was Perry. That was brutal and just. Ugh.
So that was your favorite.
Yeah, I guess. Most effective death. I don't know. They're all gross. They're all horrible.
So I guess if you have to pick one, it's Perry.
I guess so.
Yeah. So Perry and Camille so far. R.I.P. Leo.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I think anything else before we wrap it up? Because I think we're going to have more of a robust conversation of the stuff once we finally get to the end. Yeah, of this, right?
I'm looking forward to seeing the story of young Roderick and Madeline really play out, seeing how they became so corrupt.
Madeline was always
right. Yeah. But like, what's going to happen to Annabelle and how all that's going to shift and shape who Roderick is? Mm. Because, I mean, Roderick as a character, he's a strong character, and he is leading us through this entire story. So I'm very curious to seeing what happened and, you know, who that jester was in the back of the limo.
Oh, my God. Funny enough, so Bruce Greenwood, who plays Roderick, wasn't supposed to be Roderick when they started making the show. And then whoever was supposed to play him originally, there were scheduling conflicts and stuff, and they got kicked out. Mm-hmm. And then Bruce Greenwood got in, which I like because Gerald's game. He was Gerald in Gerald's game.
Oh, wow. Yes, 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 yes. See, the Flanniverse. It's back. It's back.
It's back.
It's back.
All right. So super exciting. I'm very excited to finally watch the other four episodes.
Mm, yes.
We've been holding it off. Comic-Con kind of pushed our schedule back a little bit. But I can't wait to see it. Let us know. Are we on the right track? What are your theories? What do you like? Who's your favorite death? What's your favorite episode? Let us know.
I also want to know, maybe you have a favorite post story. Mm. I want to know that as well. Mm. Tell us.
Very true. Mm-hmm. All right. So till next week, this week, whenever you're listening to this,
you'll hear from us.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to A Bite Of. Artwork and editing by our own Noah. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at A Bite Of Pod and on Facebook at A Bite Of. If you have any questions, recommendations, or just want to say hi, you can contact us on abiteofpod.com. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review to spread the word. See you next time on A Bite Of. Bye.